I don't know how to directly answer or engage that you pose, but I a few strains that have occurred to me keying off of the presentations this morning. I think one thing is, like you talked about, that the AIDS movement per se, as a self-organized, widespread group of people with a set of goals of achieving government response to the epidemic through research, through attention, through expanded service, and so forth, largely devolved into both a low level of activity and into a kind of establishment advocacy role as successes were achieved on the one hand, as initial leadership died or left the struggle for another, as new populations and groups became more heavily impacted who were less accustomed and had less leadership in place to take role as a demanding constituency from the government. So that part of what I bring here, part of what is kind of like, and what Don and I came together around is, okay, what do we do now? Because AIDS is still a crisis, particularly worldwide, but it's not so widely perceived as such anymore. Within the country, and it's the consciousness and awareness of it is fractured a lot more by according to the different communities that are impacted, which on the one hand is one reason why AIDS and HIV becomes a metaphor and engages a lot of people still in social struggle, because you can't deal with AIDS without dealing with all the relationships of capitalism and imperialism and the various forms of special oppression and the failure of governmental forms. Immigration, migration, and citizenship. I mean, everything, special oppression, particularly women, of gay people, comes into play. But yet, obviously, a lot of what has happened in a competition for shrinking resources and for keeping alive organizations is the usual kind of compete, setting one community against each other, people narrowly fighting for resources to keep doors open to provide services that on the one hand are valuable, but on the other hand are very narrowly conceived, and are generally provided, as one thing that we've discovered in this process, without a lot of consultation with the people for whom they're intended. But by people who have, even if they originally were sort of activists and saw themselves as resistance, are now the keepers of the authority to provide services, to decide what people need, to decide how it should be done. So different things have happened in response. One thing is, and this is constructive in one way, but it's a small movement, is that a certain segment of the radical AIDS activists shifted their attention in the last few years to international AIDS crisis issues and trying to organize for to pressure the U.S. government and other wealthy Western capitalist countries to accept a financial responsibility of giving money to care, prevention, research in particularly Africa and Asia, to some extent Latin American AIDS. And so to leverage resources to recognizing that 95% of the world's AIDS cases right now are in resource poor countries or colonial, neo-colonial countries. But yet that sets up a sort of complex set of dynamics. So here the relatively privileged organizers in the West, to the extent that they're successful, then they acquire kind of power to decide which poor communities and countries get relatively more resources or access, even with knowledge, and who's going to administer those and all like that. I think another thing that has happened is what some of us have turned to, and I think there is a lot of possibility in, but also a lot of difficulty, is to go back to the communities of people that are living with HIV and listen. and see what's the situation, what's the need, both in terms of direct survival needs that people have, as well as how they would envision dealing with people that are at risk or are infected and don't know it in other communities like their own or where they came from. This has been challenging, partly because you have to get past the gatekeepers who prefer to control people, partly because this population is a very dispersed one across different communities and different languages and different sets of experiences. But it has been a very rich kind of thing to listen to what people need. And in a lot of ways, it ends up kind of reinforcing one thing I heard Leonardo say earlier, is that people's needs and therefore their felt kind of expressions and struggles is often not in categories that either government or movement activists think of, but it's much more day-to-day survival. The kinds of things we hear a lot is, I need housing. I need access to legal employment. I need to not be discriminated against when I have to go to the ER in San Bernardino County on Saturday night. I need to be able to get into school or to have money to pay for it. I need to be safe on the streets from gun violence that encounters. I need to be able to be openly homosexual without getting beat up or without being totally alienated from my family. I need to be able to go home to see my sick mom in Los Mochis or Merida or Aguas Calientes and be able to come back without having to wonder if I'm going to be able to get back and get access to my medicines or get shot crossing the border and so forth. So it sort of encapsulates all of these kinds of things. But another kind of strain, and this is part of this organization CHAMP that I'm a part of, the Community HIV/AIDS Mobilization Project. One of the things that we're trying to do is to help train and support the training of organizers, especially young or new organizers or organizers that have come out of the experience of living with HIV in different communities around the country, and to some extent then link up, build bridges across the country with them. And I just came back last night from Austin, Texas. This morning I got up at 3 o'clock LA time to get back here. We have these what we call prevention justice partnerships, because one of our orientation is to take AIDS and see it as human rights issue and social justice, and that we can only deal with HIV and AIDS not in the kind of narrow medicalized public health, but as a social justice human rights issue that relates to all these other things. And here we have a new group of young people in Texas, and I was sort of saying, well, what are they like? What do they want? How did they come into this? Well, for one thing, most of them are queer, majority queer women, some minority queer men, and other non-queer identified people. They were attracted because they had a militant, resistant social justice impulse in the main, and or because they wanted to work in an environment. Some of them work in AIDS service organizations. It's one of the few places where young people can be openly queer and connect with other queer people, and there's enough specific gravity that they feel support and empowerment. Like last night, there were two people there. They were going to go to a party later of young gay men that they were working with, but she was dressed as a dominatrix. He was dressed as a slave. He was sitting there in my talk, in full restraint, and she was holding his leash, and their boss was sitting over on another side of the room. I said, there are not many contexts where that could happen. And and so part of what we're dealing with is, well, several things. One is attempting to take an intergenerational, cross-generational approach, which is one thing that maybe hasn't been explicitly said here. But me, as a 61-year-old, 45-year experienced activist who's not going to live, forever, I mean, I start thinking about these things. I mean, for whatever I've learned and however much I hope it'll be superseded, I would like to be able to at least share it with other people. And I find a great deal of hunger. A lot of times people feel like, we don't have very good ways of passing on the oral tradition or the skills and the experiences for however, not in a necessarily, usually hopefully a dictatorial way, like this is what you should do just like us, but this is what it was like. So with Chant, we're doing a lot of that, and these people and the young people in Austin were quite eager for that. Another thing that we're trying to do is to, like I say, link up, see if we can help make a transition, or if people are interested in this, if this idea is going to fly, of HIV prevention, HIV self-empowerment as a way to link different social justice struggles and organizing. Without necessarily any pre-agenda, I think a lot of it's going to come. What's going to become most salient? Is it migration issues, prison issues, queer empowerment theory issues? So to kind of wrap up, some of the things that I heard today that are very exciting to me. Well, first of all, as an organizer, I immediately think in a utilitarian terms. Oh, what can I use? And like Elizabeth's talk of that Dublin Housing Project experience and the building those videos and the tapes and then having the session there and that connecting with what Leonardo said about how the sound repetition is often very useful to as a mnemonic device, as a encouragement of reflection. I see a whole lot of tools and possibilities here that will help enrich organizing, particularly organizing in the context where people don't really know for sure what they want to do next, or they don't know how much power they have, or if they have enough power to do what they want to do. I see tools that can help us reflect, can help us share the wisdom that's greater collectively than, you know, not only in any one person, but than we thought we had. I see also the power of silence, of taking breaks, of taking for reflection as a time for us to sort of think and listen and learn about what we should do next rather than just sort of try to automatically repeat stuff that hasn't worked very well before, but it's the only thing we know how to do. And we feel like if we don't keep running, we're going to lose everything and all disappear and lose contact with each other. When oftentimes taking a break, stopping, thinking, looking across different experiences is what we need. Another thing is, I see it as a way to help us think, you know, help expand vision. And by it, I guess I'm talking about incorporating art of its various forms.
And little by little, we've been able to find like a small group of people. Of these 300 families who live there, we have a small group of people, about 5 or 10, who finally have been able to come to the organization, to the Unión de Vecinos, and say, oh, we need help. And after 2 years of working, just trying to get them motivated, the last 2 weeks, we went outside into the development, these families, and passed out 300 flyers telling people you have rights. You have rights to do X, Y, and Z. And, I mean, it was a lot of fear to get there. But the pleasure that they had afterwards, after they were able to go in the middle of the night and put on every single door in the development this flyer, and know that the next day or that at the end of the day, security and everybody was going to find out that this group of people had done this, it was just tremendous. And it was so tremendous that the next day they wanted to do it again. So I mean, here's a moment where I don't see the, but it's the pleasure comes at the end of the process. And so I don't see the limits of that. I think that was fantastic. And also the narrative that Elisa was giving about when we were doing, when we did the thing in the projections, that was at a time where we had actually lost a lot of battles. And people were pretty much locked themselves into their homes in depression. They were not using the public spaces anymore. Nothing happened. And that day, you know, we have the projections. People from all over Los Angeles are coming. And we have a 15-year-old, a quinceañera celebration, and everybody ends up dancing salsa. And everyone was very excited, and that relaunched us to another series of campaigns. And again, for me, the pleasure came at the end of this process. But it's a different kind of pleasure. Like, for example, when you do a campaign and you're trying to shoot to win, and then you win and you celebrate. In these two cases, we have pleasure in the middle of a campaign, in the middle of a process, and it comes out of a fear, really. And so to find activities, to find practices, to put yourself in spaces to create sounds that move you out of this fear into this place of pleasure that bounces you to move on. To me, that's very special. And that's something I found in this kind of process, to be able to look in the middle of the despair and find the pleasure and that launches you out of the despair. And to me, that has no limits. I mean, to be able to always find those places, find those moments, it's really a good organizing force, a great organizing force, because it builds community, it builds relationships, and doesn't take you to this place that I was talking about before, where you have to have a victory and everything ends and there is this big climax and everything is celebrated. Life is not like that, you know? And life is like, some days you feel like going to work, some days you don't, but in the middle of the day something happens that launches you to go on. And those are the kind of things, the moments that I think helps us in our everyday organizing.
I don't see the limits of the pleasure. I think the pleasure does happen at the end, as Leonardo was describing, but I also saw it as constant throughout the process. When I'm thinking back in terms of, I mean, the project I described was after 3 years of work together. And so I saw it constantly during video interviews, during sound recordings, as youth were playing with the camera. I saw it constantly as we engaged in each activity, as coming through and continuing the energy and continuing the momentum. And maybe some moments were more pleasurable than others, but it was definitely, I think, a very constant presence throughout the entire process.
Do you want to say something? No, you're done. Okay. I would end my contribution by asking, what do you see as the limits of pleasure? And I would also tend to answer in the same way like Elizabeth and Leonardo did, that I don't see that there are really limits. Let me give you two examples. Before I was doing Kanakatak, I was involved in producing a journal that was published quarterly. And it was one of the experience of doing kind of politics within the left, and it was really painful. It was painful in lots of ways, and painful was that we were sitting there sometimes not talking to each other for 10 minutes, and this was not the silence that Don talked about. But it was, no one dared to say something because he or she feared that it will be criticized. I learned a lot. I loved the journal. It was really good journal, but it was really painful. And from this experience derived also, when this ended, also very painful, derived the idea of doing something completely different that would not be producing a journal, but would be like doing organizing, doing all the stuff that we did with Kanakatak. And it was kind of an idea of doing the opposite of what we have done there, and at the same time, politically, from a lot of thoughts, you know, like a continuation. And I think we succeeded. It was really fun. There were no meetings that I ever recall where there would no one say anything. It was the opposite. Like 10 people would talk at the same time. There were fights and struggles, and we would scream at each other, and we would laugh, and we had the best parties in town. And it was really pleasure. It was fun to do politics. And in fact, it was possible for a lot of people who would usually not do politics as we conceive politics to join it. And that made a big difference. And it's up until today when I go to activists' meeting that I completely don't understand why people are sitting there. I don't understand it. And I must say, you know, the nerves that you have to have, the ability to sit down and listen to all of this, that you know exactly who has been sitting there before and agreeing on what is going to be the result of the meeting. And you feel, you know, they are insulting your intelligence, they are using up your time, and this is no pleasure. And that's why I don't really see why pleasure is a limit. And one of the you know, like really nice posters, for example, that I like within the German left was actually a poster of the Red Army fraction, where you see a couple of these people from the RAF, and it says, the most beautiful youth of Germany is imprisoned. And I always liked that, because it would never say, it would not talk about suffering, it would not talk about repression and all of this, but it turned it around, and it was a perfect way of, you know, like, and giving this term beautiful a lot of different meanings. When I was in Argentina last October, I was talking to a friends from the Colectivo Situaciones, and they were in a situation where they said that all this rising up, all this everyday life organizing that was actually happening and taking place and possible after the collapse of the economy, that this completely, there was nothing left of this. And there were a couple of groups left who keep on struggling and activate and kept on doing things, and they were all in a depression. And what they would organize was saying they would organize the sadness. And this is what I thought about when you said there might be limits to pleasure, because I think that there are situations that we cannot ignore and that are not pleasurable, and that are they are about suffering, and we cannot be silent about them. We cannot be silent about the 1,000 deaths per year that of migrants that try to cross the Gibraltar Strait of Gibraltar and that are dying. Every year, 1,000 people. And this is only this little part of the Mediterranean. And I think there are situations, and we have been talking a lot, Dawn and me, about this, where you have a situation that is really difficult. And then going back to organizing pessimism, as Benjamin put it, or organizing sadness, as the people in Argentina said, might be a concept that has nothing to do with pleasure, but then I think have to bring up situations, have to bring up moments where a collectivity, a different way of thinking about the social world and social relations, a different way of thinking or conceiving yourselves and your social relation, to me at least, always brings pleasure, and I don't see any limits to that.
Yeah, as you know, I've been playing around with this idea of organizing the silence. And I mean, in our conversations that we've had, you know, we've talked a lot about within those ACT UP meetings, the constant oscillation between a high level of anxiety and a high level of pleasure was exhausting, frankly. It was really exhausting. And it's almost like you couldn't have that anxiety without the pleasure, but you also couldn't have the pleasure without the anxiety, because it was that level of anxiety that created the context for the dark humor, that created the context for the camp, you know, the sticker, you know your scumbag with a picture of Cardinal Mahoney, you know? I mean, those things are funny, but they're funny because they're within a context where there's so much anxiety. And within these discussions that we've been having with support groups and with clients and with people in the AIDS activist movement, I wouldn't say that the pleasure isn't there, neither in the same way that I wouldn't say that anger isn't there, but the language for it is not there. And so rather that when it comes to actually facilitating their experiences into a language, what becomes available to them and only available to them is precisely confusion, frustration, sadness, and grief. So then you just sort of work with what you have. And I think one of the things that we're seeing with these performances, and you know, we haven't heard from Eddie, it'd be interesting to hear what his response to this is at the end of the performances, the high level of excitement that the performance produces, even though they're really grim affairs. I mean, some of you were at the Hammer event, and the Hammer event ended with this guy talking about his experience in Germany during the 1930s, and his, you know, identification with the AIDS survivor next to him as someone who's also lived through a Holocaust, and then they hugged. I mean, it was really a difficult moment. But that sort of connection, the possibility that there could be a connection within an art practice even, and within an organizing practice, even if the connection is based around grief and loss, you know, to produce those connections, I think is in itself a kind of bittersweet pleasure that I would just hope we wouldn't immediately burden with "are we having fun yet" kind of ideas of pleasure, because it's too deep. It's just too deep.